It's the Brady and the Bunch podcast, presented by 101.3 The Game.
All right, welcome back to the Brady and the Bunch podcast. This one is a unique one. I've done a lot of interviews in a lot of interesting locales, but this one, I am literally stepping off the treadmill at Orange Theory Fitness here, talking with our coach at Orange Theory Fitness, Coach Jeremy. What's up? Now you're in my world.
This is so uncomfortable.
Last hour I was in your world. Yeah. Now you're in my world. So appreciate you joining me, because you got a really cool backstory. And just the people want to know this question before we really get into it.
Sure.
All of us at the huddle do Orange Theory, Arnie, Rich, and I. Yeah. We've been doing it for a year and a half. The public wants to know, what does Arnie look like at Orange Theory?
Well, shirt on or shirt off?
Oh! Well, he wears three shirts during class.
He totally does. It's kind of funny, because he was in the other day, and he was yelling at me because I hadn't changed the VVA board, and he's like, Jeremy! And I'm like, oh man, I'm going to be like that failure. I'm going to be like the worst class, according to you guys, like the worst coach that's possible. Yeah, he's focused on doing everything correctly. You know, he's a student of exercise.
Arnie being a student of anything is not something that I would have thought. And what is Rich like at Orange Theory?
I haven't seen Rich in a minute. So Rich, everybody brings something a little bit different. You know, Rich has got his little bit of a challenge. You know, it's like sweating in his hat.
The fact that he wears a hat during the workout, I have said, there's always the Mount Rushmore of gym faux pas. For me, number one is the guy who wears the hat.
Man, I come in and I'll wear a hat, and then at some point I pop it off, because you're just like, oh my God, I am dying. This thing is trapping heat.
The thing about Rich is, not only is he guy who wears the hat while working out, he's guy who then wears that hat around afterwards. So he's got the double whammy as far as I'm concerned.
I haven't sat in his car for an Uber ride, or is that public
knowledge? No, that's public knowledge. Trust me, it's well documented that Rich likes Uber, and it's actually good, because it forces him to keep his car clean.
Yeah, sure.
You might have missed the story on the air one day where Rich took home a leftover slice of pizza from a restaurant gig that we did not have a plate, so stuck the piece of pizza on the front seat of his car, and that's how he transported it back.
Oh, nice.
So the Uber car is much cleaner than that old car was.
Well, that's Uber food, or what is it?
Uber Eats.
Uber Eats,
He does just Uber regular. Okay. That was just his own personal, I want to take leftovers. What do you like about teaching in Orange Theory?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. And so, originally I had an athlete from my basketball team, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. She lived in Indianapolis. After she retired, she decided she was going to buy an Orange Theory.
Okay.
And I think at the time, you know, I was still doing my athletic training work, and we had gone out, and her and her husband had come and collected me and my PR guy, and we went out to eat, and she was like, hey, take a look at this. And I was like, yeah, it's probably some new gimmick. There's always some kind of fad going. This was only a couple years ago, and Orange Theory had been out for at least 5 years prior to that. And she's like, no, but seriously, check this out. And she hit a couple points that really kind of resonated with me, which are obviously there's so much more of a focus as far as kind of having a coach making sure the instruction is proper, but your heart rate based, which I have always since I got out of school in 92, was always training clients, it's you have to buy a heart rate sensor. And back in the day, you know, they were $150 for a cheap one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I wasn't going to buy one for people. I'd always encourage people. But I'm like, look, you have to know what your heart rate is to know what zone you're training in. So, you know, this kind of, you know, she started talking about that. And I'm like, well, that completely makes sense. I've been kind of That's how I train people all the time. So, you know, I was like, well, let me look into this a little bit more, and kind of, you know, found out a little bit more about it, and was like, well, this is still pretty legit. So, you know.
Yeah. This is not an Orange Theory infomercial, but I will ask one more question on Orange Theory. What, you know, we've actually, since we started coming, gotten a lot more men to start coming to class. That's been one of the focuses for us, is trying to market the business to men. And we've noticed that a lot more men have started coming than when we first started. I think there's this perception by men that classes are a female thing. Yeah. But I'm I love it, because when I go to the gym, I'm incapable of getting a workout done efficiently. It's the minute I walk into a gym, it's okay, set of curls, talk to somebody, drink of water, set of curls, talk. It's taken me like a half an hour. And then, by the way, where's the basketball court? And that's just what happens. Like, I can't do it on my own.
Well, first off, you got to do probably less bicep curls. And maybe like...
I'm getting too big. I'm getting too darn big. That's why.
Shirt's getting tight.
Yeah. So the schmedium, as Arnie likes to call it.
The schmedium, nice. Yeah, I think, it's different kind of, you know, it seems like group fitness is always based around kind of like a female clientele, and I don't know why. I mean, part of it might just be like guys feel like they can create their own workouts, or there's not going to be a class that's challenging
enough.
We
can't even ask for directions. How can we create our own workout class?
Yeah, well, yeah, right. And we give you those directions, so you actually don't have to ask, you just have to listen and kind of follow. Yeah, so I think it's interesting because, again, you know, being the only male coach here, you know, I kind of feel like, wow, you know, kind of odd. It reminds me again of working with my basketball team, female basketball team.
Now, you mentioned your basketball team that you used to work with. You mentioned it being a female team. You were a athletic trainer for a team in the WNBA for the Connecticut Sun. That, how did you get into that? Because that's a pretty sought after position, I'd have to imagine, being an athletic trainer for a professional team.
Yeah, you know, people are knocking at the door for that one. I mean, it's, you know, when you look at, like, you know, kind of across the board with the WNBA versus the NBA, and again, it's a sister company of the NBA. Not that many NBA teams own WNBA franchises anymore. They're almost all kind of independent, but it's still run by the same league.
Yep.
But when you look at the guy side of things, again, it's like, you know, it's exponential with everything. Amount of people helping, money involved, like all of that. So, you know, it's a little different, like kind of overall. But how it happened for me, I was working at, you know, Mohegan Sun for a number of years at a fitness center. Again, just kind of like, you know.
I thought it was like a blackjack dealer is what you're
saying. Yeah, no, not a blackjack dealer. No, no. At the fitness center. And, you know, we had, I was, at the time, I was working out, I was personal training one of our executives, two daughters.
Yep.
Girls basketball. I was doing a lot of AAU basketball. I kind of, you know, as an athletic trainer, you always kind of find, like, what is your niche? Like, which sport do you kind of want to work in? And you continue to go that route, hopefully early on in your career, so you can kind of blossom it. And I think because I was doing a lot of basketball, I think he must have said something to the coach, because they had bought a team, and the coach came in to work out, and he's like, oh, hey, you know, I just want to introduce myself, blah, blah, blah. And so I interviewed for it. I was in that weird catch-22 of, like, it's a new team, we're moving to a new location, it's a new coach, and you're a guy.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I can't really change that, you know, so tell me what I can do. And so he basically put me in touch with the athletic trainer at that time. This is like 2003.
Yeah.
I reached out to her, and we weren't able to kind of connect in that season. And then four, they had a new athletic trainer, and we did connect, so I basically became kind of an assistant, pro bono. I mean, I was just kind of there really to get my foot in the door, to give myself that, to get out of that catch-22 of saying I didn't have the experience in that. You know, now I did. And then in 06, I was hired full-time and then worked there for 12 years.
So what's the day-to-day grind in the season? Are you traveling with the team on the road? Is it only for home games? How is it working out in that regard?
Yeah, so that, you know, grind was a good word, because it's, you know, we would start in, you know, April for the most part. You know, you're prepping, you know, anywhere from like March, January on. You know, your athletes are overseas, you're checking in on them. But you're watching the college draft. As that goes through, you're starting with, you know, taking a look at people that your coaches are interested in. So you do this medical background check. Once you get all your people in, then it's basically managing, like, the medical staff. I mean, they used to joke that I had, like, 20 people on my medical staff.
But
I had a doctor in every kind of discipline, because, like, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, these are the top-level athletes. You want to make sure that they're cared for. And, like, if you have some sort of GI problem, like, that's not my thing.
Yeah,
I need to have a primary care doc that can do it, or a neurologist, or, you know, obviously an ortho, a chiropractor, you know, I'd have a PT that was kind of in, obviously strength coach. But so every day it's managing the players with their 12 individual issues. It's managing your medical team. You know, it's getting ready for, you know, our we would practice at like 11 to 1. So you're getting in at 9 doing your treatments before. you do your practice, you take care of any sort of treatments that you have after, and then anything beyond that is scheduling like MRs or x-rays or driving people to appointments or, you know, I basically at that point then kind of got to like push it off and to say, hey, look, you know, you guys got to be a little bit more independent, or yeah. I'd have someone else kind of take them and move them along. But yeah, we would obviously traveled. So when I would travel, the interesting thing is like, you're limited with the number of people. You have 16 people that are allowed in your travel party by league rules. So okay. You have 12 people on the team. You have like four coaches, athletic trainer, strength coach. Already you're kind of pushing that envelope. So at that point we kind of double up. So the strength coach became like the travel person. I became the equipment person,
okay. Or
some sort of variety of that kind of combo. Through those years, and I never wanted to do the travel because that's like, you know, all of a sudden the airplane doesn't land, you know, yeah. doesn't show up, and all of a sudden you're calling the travel agent to be like, hey, look, what are we going to do? I said, I'll take care of all the bags. I would move 30, 40, wow. 50 bags. You know, I had 12 hockey bags myself with equipment
oh my
that would
God.
Be moved back and forth, you know. Lucky enough that they gave me all the tip money so that yeah. I could take care of everybody to move all my stuff for me.
Yeah.
But I just had to coordinate all that.
So everything you were doing was more medical-based as opposed to you weren't the person developing the workouts. You weren't the person saying, okay, hey, we're at shoot-around, and this is how we're warming up for stretching. Or was that you?
Well, so that's kind of an interesting side. So at home, no, I had a great strength coach. Later on, was finally able to bring like one of my buddies in. Does a great job. Tim Juhas, nice work. A little plug for Tim. Anyway, so, yeah, so Tim and I worked, you know, kind of hand-in-hand. At the beginning of the year, we would do kind of assessments on the athletes and find out, and our physical therapists, to find out, you know, what issues would potentially come about based on, you know, dysfunctional movement patterns that our athletes presented. So we'd create programs off of that. His would be kind of focused into their rehab, into their strength conditioning program.
Yep.
Mine would be focused into a rehab program, kind of preventatively driven, unless someone came with a, you know, acute injury that, you know, we'd take care of. So at home, no, Tim would take care of all the strength conditioning. He'd warm them up. For games and for practice when we went on the road at some point in my career, I became that strength guy. So it was like, you know, I would get the athletes ready pregame at the hotel. We'd go to the game. I'd get ready, tape them up
yep.
at the game, whoever needed to get taped. And then I would run out to the court and
wow.
I'd do two groups of like warm-ups.
Yeah.
And then I would run back, I'd change, get ready for the game, take care of any acute issue there. And then after the game, again, deal with any acute stuff or anything that happened to pop up. And then get ready to move all the bags for wherever you're traveling to next. The only thing I didn't need to do is take care of like the flight and call and print out everybody's boarding pass, which I was glad to be like, no, someone else can do that. I'll take care of all this other stuff.
You know, it's crazy because I think about minor league baseball, or I think about baseball teams. They have, you know, control over the players all year round, right? Like, you know, the guy in single A is in constant communication with the parent club all year long. It's like, okay, this is what we're doing in the offseason. This is your offseason plan. This is how much you're going to throw. We're going to see you at spring training here, and then we're going to do this together.
Yeah.
You don't have that luxury in the WNBA because you mentioned your season's 3-4 months long, and then the players are going to play overseas. So you're not really having that access to them. So you kind of have no control over what they're doing in the offseason, I would imagine. How difficult is that? Because you kind of have a window where it's like, I don't know what they're doing at this point.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Well, I mean, the season is 5 or 6 months.
Oh, five
so
or
we'll,
six months. Okay.
We'll end in September, October, and it really depends on an Olympic year. Sometimes the
yep.
Olympics moves things around and worlds and all that stuff. But most of them, I would say 11 out of 12 would be going overseas. We would have one, you know, that was maybe like Carol Lawson, Sinead McKay, that are working.
Carol Lawson, new coach of the Celtics. She just got hired by the Celtics.
Really?
Within the last...
Wow.
This is going to air...
Good for her.
This is going to air early in September. This is probably late in June or early in July that Carol Lawson got hired by the Celtics. We'll get back to that.
Okay. Anyways. So, like, you'd have a couple people that were working ESPN that were...
Yeah.
You know, that's the route that they wanted to go. But they might... You know, Carol was in Bristol a lot. Lived in, you know, in Connecticut still. Chennai's out in L.A. So she ended up getting traded this past year for that. So the rest of them know they're overseas. And usually what happens is you start getting blown up. Like, I'm pretty happy, my wife's very happy that I can put my phone down and not pay attention to it. But before it was like every 5 minutes I'd be like, you know, what's happening? What's going on?
Yeah.
But something would happen and all of a sudden you'd get inundated with, you know, emails, texts, WhatsApp.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I did this, you know, like, what do I need to do? And, you know, it's interesting because when they get hurt, they become a workers' comp case. You
know,
typically,
okay.
So a lot of times, if you're going to bring them back from getting injured overseas, then who's covering that cost? So it raises a whole bunch of issues, and it becomes kind of like, you know, I mean, like a weird side thing. Like, you know, I did all the marketing initially and sponsorship for my own medical staff. So basically kind of sold these people on why should you work with the team kind of a deal when I'm, you know, we're kind of trade instead of paying you, we're going to trade you, you know, whatever. Yeah. So then you'd be presented with, hey, this girl now needs surgery. Would you be willing to do that?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, at what kind of a cost to you kind of a deal? So it was interesting. There's a lot of weird situations that you'd have to kind of like, just kind of work your way through. But that's you know, the nice thing about being, you know, there for so long. And that's why you see a lot of these people like in the NBA, in the NFL, Major League Baseball, like athletic trainers or that staff just cycle through because we've seen so many things and been presented with so many scenarios that people in upper management just want to know that you can deal with it, and they don't want to deal with medical.
Yeah.
They don't want it to be an issue. You need to be fixing things and move on, like Kevin Durant kind of, you know, it's like fix things and move on, and then unfortunately situations happen up and you're like,
yeah.
Whoa, you know, what happened? So
why is the word trainer, it's like a four-letter word? Because I've learned that the athletic training community, if you just call them a trainer, they get very, very upset. You must say athletic trainer. Do you feel that way, too?
No,
I've been yelled at by a trainer. I was doing an interview once a couple years ago.
Because you said it wrong again.
Yes, exactly. I was like, well, you got the trainer for this team. And he goes, no, I'm an athletic trainer.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, then. Well, then.
I've never been really hung up on that whole thing. Like, honestly, I don't care. Like, at the end of the day, like, even working, you know, with WNBA, you're so behind the scenes. You realize you have a level of importance that you kind of like find for yourself, and the athletes appreciate it and the coaches appreciate it, but it's kind of like you're not that important. You're not that big of a deal. You're not an athlete. You don't own the team. Like,
yeah.
There's a pecking order. So like, you know, keep that real, like stay like in your lane.
So that person was wrong.
No. but technically, yes, we are athletic trainers because you have personal trainers, you have horse trainers, you have, you know,
gotcha.
Sports train, whatever the term is thrown around. And the reason that it popped up is because of Roger Clemens.
Okay.
And his, you remember this when he was getting injected by his trainer. Do you remember this guy?
There's the Balco guy.
The guy that was actually injecting him.
Yeah. Victor something.
Yeah. Right? So, you know, so anyways, they kept
Victor Conti, maybe.
They kept bringing up, like, so he was injected by his trainer, and and even before that, the professional was like, hey, look, we're athletic trainers, which is true. Because people were throwing that around, we, as a profession, had to kind of come out and be like, hey, look, that
wasn't us.
That's not us. Like,
yeah.
we know better than that.
Yeah.
So it kind of was giving, like, a bad reputation or a bad name to athletic trainers overall. So people got kind of worked up. And I'm sure in more the collegiate setting where, you know, they're sending people out every year to be like, hey, look, don't take nothing for salary and don't, you know, let people call you just a trainer. You're an athletic trainer. So, you know, stand up for yourself. So
that's
probably got
goes.
Hit with a younger person. I kind of,
it was
like,
a younger person and it was, know, a college person. So
nailed it.
Yeah. There you go. So you got that, you know, I'm sure you hear, whether it's snickering in the crowd or whether it's people who tell you personally, but there's always the jokes about, oh, women's basketball is not that good. Oh, they're not really that good. Oh, I could beat them one-on-one. You've seen them play at the highest level.
Yeah.
How underrated is the women's game?
Well, I heard it a lot. I had a family friend that used to call it small ball all the time, which the ball is smaller. You know, the still, you know, played on the same court, same dimensions as the NBA. The ball is a little bit smaller, which, you know, I don't know. Is that something that they want to look into? Ask the NBA and the people then that run the W to be like, is that important to us? I don't know. But what I can tell you is I had an athlete, many of them. Jamie Carey pops to mind. She was an athlete from Texas. I went to Stanford, and I remember, like, kind of rehabbing with her, and I would go out and be like, okay, you know, we're just going to warm up, and we'd shoot, you know, 5-point shooting inside the three, and then 5 or 6-point shooting outside the three, and she would make 9 or 10 of 10 shots, and I'm like, at a three, and I'm like, still making them, like, they're still really good at what they do. It's just a different game, and quite honestly, like, you look at the guys, and it's like, you know, I mean, Magic Johnson,
6'9"
as a point guard?
Yeah.
Come on now. Like, the game's got to be easier. you know, you got people that, you know, they can dunk. So if, like, the girls could dunk, all of a sudden the scores go up.
Right.
Because how many dunks are there in an NBA game versus, like, a straight layup?
Many.
Yeah, totally. So you could look at it and be like, well, they don't score as much, they don't do whatever, but, like, there's different high percentage plays that the guys can make that the girls can't, and that's not their fault. They're just, you know, they're not 7 feet tall. You know,
I did
have Margot Dedeck on my team, who was 7'2".
Wow.
Tallest girl in the league. Unfortunately, Margot has since died. But,
oh, my God.
Well, unfortunate. Great, great person.
You know, I've always thought that the women's game was more fundamental than the men's game. The men's game gets going faster and is more helter-skelter, but I've always felt that the women's game was far more fundamental. Like, if you wanted to just sit somebody down and say, okay, I'm going to teach you basketball, the women's game I always thought would be better. They're better at the free throw line, they're better passers, there's awesome ball handling in the women's side. I've always felt that the women's game was extremely fundamental.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's things that the guys will get away with, you know, that Euro step, the carry, which is like, you know, God forbid, like, I'm sure Pistol Pete rolling over his grave, like, dribbling with his hand on the top of the ball versus I'm going to carry from underneath and kind of roll over, which is done all the time. And they don't call it because it's like, why?
Yeah.
So the girls, yeah, I mean, the girls will still kind of do that, and they'll kind of get in the side and kind of carry it over, but that's kind of where the game is going. But I don't know if I can answer that kind of like in a true coach sense, because I will say I did have a coach for a number of years that would be like, you know, he would get these players so kind of rote, if that like is kind of an appropriate term for basketball, to be like, this is a play. You go from, you know, the wing, you drop over here, you fall in, diagonal cut, and then you have a layup, whatever. And then they couldn't learn how to play basketball outside of that. And you'd get pissed to be like, just play. And it's like, well, you told them not to play. You scripted them, and now they don't know how to play. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, fundamentally, you kind of think like, you know, people should be out there playing.
Like, not too robotic.
And not be so robotic that, like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure when you play, it's kind of like, you know when to dish off.
Yeah.
And went to, like, hold on to it. And,
you know, I went to a Connecticut Sun game about a year ago, and I saw Elena Deladon play, who is one of the best players, you know, in college history, and one of the best players in the WNBA now.
She's
still.
She's
awesome.
Yeah.
Who's the best player that you saw in person? I mean, I got to imagine you've seen Elena Deladon, Taurasi. I got to imagine you've seen all of these people.
Well, yeah, I mean, gosh, I don't, but as far as, like, what, like, shooting or just overall
talent?
If you
look at, like, this is, like, I can't believe I got to see this person. Like, who's number one on the list?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, Diana Taurasi for a while. Deanna Nolan, this girl, like, there's always someone that will kind of come through and you're like, I can't wait till that girl is no longer, like, at her peak.
Yeah.
Deanna Nolan probably was the first one. She played for Detroit. And then she stopped playing here and started playing overseas and just making more money. But, like, she was one of these girls that was so quick. And people at that point would just have a hard time stopping her. So, you know, if she would pull up and hit a three, next time she'd come down and just drive past you because you're trying to block that shot. And it's like, my God, you can't do anything, you know. I mean, there's a bunch of pure shooters. You know, one of our girls that was Orange Theory that kind of sparked me on to Orange Theory, Katie Douglas, you know, great shooter, just an amazing. Nakisha Sales, like, I remember seeing this girl, like, in college, and she's from New Britain, so, well, I never saw her, like, in high school, but remember, you know, she set the record at UConn before Taurasi went and broke it, and then she came in, and this girl was just smooth, like, these shots, you know. We would have won a championship if it were not for the fact that she was going back and forth with Katie Smith, I think it was, for Seattle, and it was like, you know, 30, they were both scoring in the third. They were just
on. It was like Durant versus LeBron.
Seriously, it was. And they were going back down, shooting threes and ripping. Keish had the last opportunity with about 3 seconds, got the ball way down on the wing, was too deep in the corner, and hit the backboard.
Yeah, I've done that before. Been there.
But it's funny because, like, you know, I mean, she was so on in that game. It would have gone in if she was, like, an inch closer. And our PR guy would talk about it and be like, man, I remember that shot. He's like, from where I was sitting, and I didn't have her angle where I was sitting, that ball was on trajectory to go in. They would have won their only championship to date.
Yeah.
And it missed, but, you know. So, I don't know. I mean, off the top of my head, you know, There's so many. I mean, like, seeing a 7-2 player is pretty impressive. You know, Mario Didek. You know, nowadays, Brittany Griner. I mean, though, you know, Brittany's got a pretty impressive game. She's 6'7", you know, can dunk. Not the fastest, you know, it'd be nice to have a little bit of speed under that, but still you start getting these kind of, like, unstoppable, like, because you, whoever's defending you is 6'4". You know, I mean, you're 3 inches above them, and then you jump another 6 inches, you can't stop it, you know, so.
The women's players, are they easier to deal with, in quotes, than you would think the men's players were? Because they're not, the men's players, you just associate, okay, they're making a lot of money, they all have massive egos. The women's players, they're not making as much money. Do they still have those same egos, or are they easier to deal with?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say originally, when I started in the league, and, like, even four, we had some of the old school, again, Katie Douglas, and Nikisha Sales, Margaret Edex, though Margaret was the kindest person, but you had people that started the league.
Yeah.
You know, when they started the league, they were paying them, I think, whatever. You know, it was like, you know, again, this is, people are going to laugh, but, like, you know, 150, 160, 200,000, whatever, to a league that now is still paying just over 100,000 for your top player, 115 it might be, compared to whatever the lowest guy makes at, I don't know, 275, 500, something like that. So it's just way different, but even still, that group was kind of like, was an inner circle.
Yeah.
And you had to break through the inner circle to be able for them to trust you. And for me, you know, was coming in and, you know, doing some hands-on technique or, you know, whatever, and helping them out with something. And then all of a sudden you become on the inner circle. You know, it's funny because, you know, I remember, like, going out and meeting up with some athletes, and next thing you know, it's like John Abrams or Abraham played for the Jets.
Yeah, John Abraham, defensive end.
Abraham, yeah. So we're hanging out with him, and he brings us up into where, you know, the Jets had just played Pittsburgh, and now all of a sudden you're back of the house, and now you're in a crew that's kind of like, I somehow snuck into that bubble and got into the inner circle, and there's Jerome Bettis walking by, and I'm like, oh my God, there's Ben Roethlisberger, you know, and you're like, oh, you know, like, should I be here kind of deal? Like, so once you get into that little circle, it's way different. But yeah, there's, you know, they were hard to break through. I think my last 6 or 7 years, I became, like, that older guy that was kind of like, I mean, I was, through three coaches, I was the only person other than a GM who eventually then left. So we had a new GM that was the same person all the way through. I was kind of like the Ed Lassert of, like, you know, Ed was with the Celtics for 19 years. I mean, no one spends that time with a team. So, yeah, I think at that point, like, the girls were kind of like, whatever, he's been here forever. We're just not going to mess with it. We'll just kind of, you know, And as I got older and they got younger, I think there was just a natural respect that came along with it. And honestly, my last couple years, like, those athletes were phenomenal. And it could have been the culture in Connecticut. Could have just been we got lucky. Could have been how they interviewed, you know, when the coach wanted to bring on his people for his team, you know. I don't know any combination of that.
You know, I read a story a couple months ago that was pretty fascinating. It was about So I don't even know if people know this a lot of time, but in college basketball on the women's side, there will be men's players, they're not on the actual team, but there will be men who come and practice with the women's team. And, you know, like, I could go and practice with the women's team, and they're just looking for more athletic players, more bodies to practice, trying to bump up their competition level. They do that in the WNBA also, so they bring in male players that are not NBA players or anything, but they bring in male players to practice with the WNBA players. And I got one of the guys who did it said, like, those girls will crush guys that come to these practices. Like, guys will think they'll walk on the court and they're just going to be just, you know, taking these women's players to task. It's like, nope, you're not going to do that. They are that good. Yeah. You've seen that in action. Is that true?
Well, so that's funny. So then another job that I had was basically finding all the practice players because I was the one guy that lived in the area.
Yeah.
So I'd have connections to, you know, a couple of colleges, whether it was Conn or Mitchell College, Coast Guard, you know, so I knew the coaches at each of these because I had spent time, like, working at them all. So I'd bring in these guys. We did have a couple guys, well, from the Coast Guard Academy that were, they're smart, you know. So they know what they need to do. The coaches love them because they would tell them, here's the play we're trying to defend against. This is what we need you guys to do on offense or on defense or whatever.
Yeah.
you know, some Mitchell College kids we had came in that were eventually playing overseas that were, you know, they could have been a D2 or a D1 person. They just had found themselves at a D3 program for whatever reason, would kind of match up very well. And again, if the guy's like 6'5", 6'6", 6'7", 6'8", I mean, that's still a little bit unfair because you can dunk over someone who's not as tall as you. It doesn't, like, that's going to happen in the NBA. It's going to happen, guys or girls. It doesn't matter. But, I mean, it was funny because the first thing that I would say when a practice player came in would be like, do not hurt my athlete.
Yeah.
You know, do not do something that's going to be just foolish and showboating or showing off or whatever. And then I kind of backed off. And then the girls would just kind of, like, I mean, they would be elbowing. They would, I mean, they're brutal. They're
policing, you know, their own game.
I mean, when people, like Diana Taurasi, you know, watching her play, you just kind of, as an athletic trainer, you're just like, oh my gosh, seriously? She is like elbowing or shouldering, you know, people as they run through the lane just to make it hard. And it's like, that's the kind of athlete that you want.
Yeah.
That stuff would happen in practice just, you know, with the guys coming in. But it was great after a while because, like, you know, we would give the guys whatever, you know, they'd get tickets, to vouchers to games. We'd give them gear. The girls after a while became friends with these people. And it was, you know, it was kind of nice to see this kind of, you know, kind of mutual respect. And the guys were so proud of the fact of being able to work, you know, with the girls. Chris Dunn was practiced against us several times.
Chris Dunn of the, well, he played at Providence. Was the number
PC.
Three pick in the draft, I think.
Three or four.
Yeah, drafted by Timberwolves, yeah. I think. And then he was up with the Bulls for a while. I'm trying to remember here off the top of my head. I got no notes in
better,
front of me,
yeah,
people.
Yeah, you're
so
much better than I am, yeah, right?
But Providence College.
Yeah, so Chris Dunn, his dad, worked for Mohegan. So, you know, we knew him from kind of floating around. And he had asked if, you know, Chris could come in and kind of, you know, play around. Chris was, I don't remember if he was, I don't think he was rehabbing from anything in particular at that time, but he went to school in New London, one of the high schools that I'd worked at. So, you know, we got even a bunch of high school kids to come in, select kids, of course, you know, ones that, you know, weren't knuckleheads and ones that really could kind of, you know, push whatever we needed. 3-point shooter was coming up in the next game. We need some kid to, you know, kind of sit out there and rip some threes.
Sounds like the best job ever. Just get out there. Hey, Brady, you're going to practice. Yeah. Just get out there just and just chuck all the time. That sounds like the perfect game plan to me. Yeah. It sounds like hire me for that job.
Stay underneath and just be a big body. You know, so yeah, so Chris came in, I don't remember how many times, but, you know, there was a, you know, every once in a while, he'd take the ball and just be like, step, you know, crossover, dunk, and you're like, okay, you know, we're not going to stop that. I mean, the guy's a lottery pick.
Yeah,
he like, you know, let's be realistic here.
So it sounds like it's a busy, exhaustive, but prestigious and great gig. Why'd you leave it?
Yeah, so great question. Yeah, so in addition to that,
in addition to these other 94 jobs, I had a 95th job.
So we had picked up my last 3 years. We picked up indoor lacrosse, and we talked about that a
little bit. Yeah, that's right.
So box lacrosse, you know, if people aren't familiar with that, basically, a little bit more of kind of like a northern sport, Canadian, very native. I mean, lacrosse is native
sport. American influence.
We're at a Mohegan, the Mohegan tribe, which is owned by the Mohegan tribe.
Yeah.
Right. You know, the town that I grew up in was Ledyard, which has Foxwoods, which is the Mashantucket tribe. So there was two very large Native American tribes. Mohegan just kind of went the route of like whatever. You know, collecting sports. I think upper management just kind of liked that stuff. But I remember at one point they're like, well, what do you know about lacrosse? And I'm like, well, you know, I mean, I love it. And like, I've worked it enough. And I, more importantly, I know the body, so it doesn't really matter what sport they play. And I was like, well, why are you asking? And next thing I know, they bought a team from Philadelphia, brought them up, part of the NLL. But box lacrosse is, you know, played on an ice rink, so we basically had to build kind of like a rink in our arena for these guys to come in. And so when they started, you know, there's 9 teams in the league. 4 of them were Canadian, okay. five of them are in the States or vice versa. So we'd end up having practices in Toronto.
Yeah.
Like on the weekend. So like I'm literally like one of the few Americans. There's a couple of other players, our equipment guy from, you know, Philadelphia, you know, they're coming up, you know, to meet me, or we're flying down to Baltimore to fly up to Toronto. And there was one point that, you know, we were leaving on Sunday. So we flew up on Friday night, leaving on Sunday for kind of like two practices there. And I'm looking at my flight and it's leaving at like 2 or 4 in the evening out of Toronto.
Yeah.
YYZ, by the way, which is a Rush.
Okay.
Like a kind of like a Rush kind of connection, which I realize, awesome spot. So anyways, you know, my flight is now like whatever. It's landing at like 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
In Hartford, and I'm like, seriously. Like, I'm waiting around all day. Our practice was at, like, 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm literally waiting in the airport, in an international airport, to just try to get home. Like,
yeah.
I'm not doing anything. I'm not helping anyone. I'm away from my family. My kids at the time, I think, were, you know, 1 and 3 or 4 and 2 or something like that. My poor wife's at home by herself, and I'm, like, sitting at the airport kind of doing whatever. And I had called, when I realized, like, I was getting back that late, I called a travel agent and was like, hey, look, is there any way you can, like, adjust this? And she's like, oh, yeah, I'll get you on an earlier flight. My earlier flight was at, say, noon, went to Atlanta and back to Connecticut. And I was like, it was 9 hours of travel.
Like,
and I was
like,
at that point, I was like, this is ridiculous. So we went through the whole year of kind of traveling back and forth. And I was able, they were gracious enough because I had been there long enough that... I was able then to just manage everything that happened in Connecticut, send the guys away. I had a guy, hired a guy on in Canada to cover practices in Canada because their practices were now on a Tuesday night. And I'm like, yo, I'm going to go up to Toronto for Tuesday night and then try to come home, which would have been Wednesday night. And like, you know, so yeah, I mean, like the schedule just was just getting loaded with... You travel in the summertime, you know, my wife's a teacher, my kids are young, that's the only time that I see them, and now I'm gone.
Yeah.
And then wintertime, all of a sudden, you know, all I have is weekends, and then I'm gone. You know, so kind of became like one of these things of like, all right, you know, I had a lot of fun, and it was a great time, but I need to refocus, and I need to kind of, you know, change my priorities with what I'm doing.
So when it comes to the career stuff, do you look at it like, I already made it to the top, and that's good enough? Like... Because a lot of people are always trying to build,
totally,
and climb.
Totally.
So you look at it like, no, I hit the peak. I was in the pros, and that's good enough, and now I'm good. Like, you still do some athletic training around here in addition to coaching in Orange Theory, so you're doing multiple different things. Like, is this, like, there's no more climbing for you at this point. Is that
well,
good
no,
you?
I mean, you know, there's always climbing because then you could, you know, develop connections, and I had some connections through the NBA. You could develop connections and kind of work, you know, into that world, which... It's a little bit more of kind of like what I did.
Yeah.
So like it's, you know, the only change, well, you get paid more, sure, that's great. But like, you know, at the end of the day, if you're not around, you know, the NBA has a great stat of like, it's like nights in bed. A buddy of mine who was working with the Wizards in addition to the Mystics, so both sides, was like, yeah, I mean, they are so big on when they can charter. And the W fly commercial. So the NBA can play a game and then fly home and you can sleep in your bed that night.
Yeah.
We don't have that. You know, we didn't have that. So there, you know, there are some benefits.
And
of
you're
kind
flying commercial.
You're flying commercial.
Sorry to cut you off, but I remember a story I heard once from an athlete. It was like an old athlete talking about playing pro football in the early 90s. And they're like, so now everybody's got private jets. And, you know, the Patriots have their team jet. And you're flying charter. And it's perfect. And, you know, in the meantime, they're running down to gate 19C trying to hit some connection. And it's like, you just picture, like, here's this WNBA team. And you're on it, like... All right, well, we got to hit our connection. We land at 24A, and now we got to get on that little monorail subway thing, and there we are in Terminal C at 38B.
Man, I can't even tell you the number of stories that we would have had, you know, kind of randomly of, like, dealing with those kind of issues. And, you know, I remember one time we were in, like, Cleveland, and our plane had to fly to, like, Detroit to get a part and come back, so you're waiting for whatever that travel, like 3, 4, 5 hours.
Wow.
Just waiting for that to happen, and it's like, no, we can't. Everybody's getting itchy. Let's get on a bus. We'll go down to Cincinnati, wherever. We drove somewhere. We got on another flight. We flew to Boston, and we drove. We got a bus driver to meet us up in Boston and come back to Boston. It was like 12 hours of travel. And, oh, yeah, by the way, I had a wedding that I was going to at the end of that day, so it was kind of like I got there right at the end, and it was like, well, you know, those are the kind of things that, like, you know, I mean, yeah, you don't expect, but, like, when you fly commercial, you never know. And, like, I remember, like, okay, I was in Saskatchewan or something with lacrosse, and you get up at, like, 4 o'clock, so, you know, if your game ended at 10:30, you get something to eat, and it's kind of like, do I sleep for a couple hours, or do I just go to get my flight? Because you're international, so 2 hours early, check 4 huge bags, whatever, I get on my flight. I am, like, falling asleep. Next thing I know, they're spraying that green foam all over it. You're like, the plane is green. Should we be flying with all this ice? And you're kind of like, what am I getting into?
Yeah.
Like, I don't, yeah. I mean, I was always happy that our season was summer. The NBA's wintertime, like, I don't want to fly in that kind of weather.
Yeah.
Imagine flying out of Burlington to kind of move, like.
Oh, crazy. Like, I will get you out of here on this. Coolest person that you have met in your career as an athletic trainer?
Well.
Partying with John Abraham doesn't count. We've already name-dropped him.
Okay, so
we need somebody other than John Abraham.
So kind of two that, like, for me, like, at the time were kind of big. So one was through a connection, an athlete that was going down to my buddies in Waco, Texas, doing this specialized kind of treatment, and I ended up going back there a couple times because I liked what they were doing, and they were like, oh, by the way, we're going down, we're going to treat a couple of the Cowboys.
Okay.
We met at Terrell Owens' house.
Wow.
Back in the day. This was after he had left Philly, so I'm talking about, like, early on.
And this is after him doing sit-ups in his driveway.
I'm telling you, like, he's laying on the table. They're like, Jeremy, go ahead and work on it. And I'm like, what the...
You're working on TO?
His arms... I remember looking at his arms, and I'm like, I think there's, like, a new muscle. Like, I identify... It was his triceps were so big, I thought it was, like, bulging out of the side of his deltoid. I'm like, I don't even know what that is right there. I'm like, this dude is awesome.
I once sat next to TO at Radio Row at the Super Bowl. We were next to... a station out of San Antonio, and they had Cowboys games on their station, so T.O. did a radio hit on their station. He was sitting right next to us. He was texting on his phone the whole interview.
Oh,
so they're talking to him. He's texting on his phone the whole interview. He still did it. Still, like, as a listener, you never would have known.
No.
He was completely distracted.
Man, he
wasn't even paying attention.
No, they are so good at that. I mean, they will not pay attention and be doing stuff. I even had an athlete that told me one time that she'd put earbuds in like she was listening to music just so people didn't talk to her. but the other one, and this happened two times, and, you know, it's like you get around these people and it's weird. You're kind of like, hey, just want to say hey, but it's like you don't want to be that guy. And we're so trained in our field or working at Mohegan that back of the house, like, you don't take pictures with these people.
Yeah.
You just that's your job. They don't want that. They don't like it. They do it because they don't want to seem like a jerk. Some people don't, you know, whatever. But so we're in Indy anyways, and, like, you know, so now you kind of have this level of, like, well, I'm not going to take a picture with people. But, like, I opened up the door and Larry Bird walks through.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, my God, I don't even know what to say. First off, like, I was shocked by the, not forgetting that he's 6'9", 6'10", whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, he's a whole head taller than me. But, like, the second time I finally was like, oh, hey, Larry, you know, how's it going? Kind of a deal, like, as he was walking, like, through the court at the end of our practice. But it's like, what do you say to Larry Legend?
Yeah,
I mean,
right?
Like, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be like, hey, can I take a picture?
Larry, you know? How's the back?
I mean, you know? Exactly. But still, like, you know, that's when I really enjoyed NBA. Magic, Larry. And you'd see these people, you know, we'd see Jack Black at our LA games directly across from where I was sitting. I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, man, I met Ben Cohen up here. And was almost more impressed by meeting Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's than some of the athletes that, you know, we've been around. I don't know. I'm just impressed by the company and what, you know, what they've done. But, like, I don't know. Yeah, you know, you've been around so many people. And, you know, they would have the Hall of Fame, you know, NBA Hall of Fame banquets at Mohegan. They're like, do you want to go? And I'm like, nah, I'm all right. I mean, Shaquille O'Neal, like, you know, all these dudes, like, coming through, and you're like...
You're so big time that you're passing on Shaq.
I don't need to be Shaquille O'Neal. Yeah.
So. Jeremy, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate it. Appreciate the time,
man,
the stories,
wow.
And
shoot.
Wait for you to kick my butt again next week.
Yeah, totally. Well, thanks for coming in, you know. Any of these listeners out here, you guys want to try out a class? First class is always free at Orange Theory. There's your plug.